broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
I inhaled my mother like the flowers surrounding my childhood home. She was the lilac bloom in the side yard that I pulled into my face as I passed by, and the delicate lily of the valley that blossomed by our front door for 2 weeks in the early spring. She was like the lady on the white shoulders box of talcum powder she used every day. The outer box was decorated with a golden cameo of a woman, her wavy long hair flowing beneath naked shoulders, the outline of her smooth breasts exposed. Inside was a pink box containing the fragrance, a molded relief of a nymph-like figure, naked and in repose, adorned the lid. A fluffy white powder puff topped with a tiny pink bow covered the treasure within. White Shoulders was distinctly her scent. It was a 1940s white flower bed of gardenias, lilacs, and lilies of the valley. The powder was her favorite. As my mother lifted the puff, a scented cloud rose up in slow motion and coated her hand.
White Shoulders by Desiree Magny. From her essay published in the current edition of the Delmarva Review, read by Ann Colwell. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. We're celebrating the publication of Volume 9 of the Delmarva Review by the Eastern Shore Writers Association today, and I'm pleased to have as my guests former executive editor of the review, Wilson Wyatt, the new executive editor, Emily Rich, and actor and poet James Keegan. In the first half of the program, we'll discuss Volume 9 of the review, just out this month, and where it stands in the long history of the review. In the second segment of the program, we'll offer a short interview with Cécile Barlier, author of the short story Immersion, published in this issue of the Delmarva Review. Immersion will then be read by the Delmarva Review's poetry editor, Ann Colwell. Wilson, Emily, James, welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be here.
It's terrific to be here. Thanks.
Wilson, let me begin with you. Tell us about the Delmarva Review, this issue, and where it stands in the long publishing history of the review.
Well, it doesn't seem like 9 years have gone by, but they have. We started the Delmarva Review 9 years ago as a literary review, Lit Mag, they call them, to publish the best writing we could find from the Eastern Shore and beyond. All writers are welcome to submit to the Delmarva Review. And we started off, our first issue had 64 pages, and we had about 100 submissions. And this year we had about 2,000 submissions, and we published the work of 36 poets and writers.
Any international writers this year, Wilson?
Not this year. We have published, in total, we've published 257 authors from around the United States and the world. Seven of them have come from other countries.
So competition is fairly stiff, I would assume, to get published in this Delmarva Review.
Competition is stiff, but it's interesting because thanks to the fact that you are a fiction editor, for example, and thanks to the fact that we have editors aboard, we read everything that is submitted. That's not true of all literary magazines. Many of them invite pieces to be published. we read everything, and we read it with at least two people, just in case there might be a disagreement over the quality of the work.
Well, I know that sometimes as the co-fiction editor with Melissa Reddish, I often read things twice as well, because I've discovered, and Emily, you're probably well aware of this, that the mood you're in when you read a particular story might impact the way you you respond. So you think, oh my goodness, I'd better go back and read that again today. I'm in a little better mood. Wilson, is there anything special about this issue of the review that you'd like to tell us about?
Absolutely. First of all, we'll start with the cover. The cover is a photograph by George Merrill, who's from St. Michael's. And it depicts, for those who can't see the cover right at the moment, when you buy the book and see it, you'll see that it depicts relationships. And even though we don't have a single theme in this issue, relationships seem to go through most of the work. And so that's the beginning. You'd have to say that the work of 36 authors is pretty special. It really is extraordinary work. 13 poets, 8 authors of short stories, 9 of nonfiction pieces, and memoir, which is very popular. And we did something unusual this year. We included a special section that lists all the books that have been published by authors on the Eastern Shore and the Chesapeake region. So there are 114 books that are listed by genre and who published them and what have you. So it's interesting to see that many come out of this small area.
What do you define, Wilson, as the Chesapeake region?
The Chesapeake region is the influence of the Chesapeake Bay to the Atlantic. And so that includes part of the Western Shore, all of the Delmarva Peninsula, which includes parts of Maryland, Virginia, and Delaware, just most of Delaware, and all the way to Washington, to Wilmington, and down to the tip of the Chesapeake Bay.
Let me ask you, Wilson, do you have a particular author in this issue that struck you as an editor, as particularly outstanding, as particularly good in any of the three genres that are published?
All 36 were excellent.
Wilson, the election is over, Wilson. You don't need to be political here. And you're not the executive editor anymore, no. So nobody is going to give you death threats.
Well, a couple of responses to your question. First of all, we have a featured editor who's with us today, James Keegan. And I really do appreciate what he contributed to this issue, because he's performed in 20 different plays, played various characters. This is the 400th year still of Shakespeare's birthday. We're gonna be celebrating his birthday until the end of December. And James is a Shakespearean actor. It's interesting to see what an actor brings from playing a character on a stage to what he takes to his writing.
Well, we're going to hear from James in a few minutes, and I'm sure our audience will appreciate the wonderful poetry that he's going to read for us. Where can our listeners get this issue of the Delmarva Review?
Well, it's very available. It's available, first of all, you can order it from Amazon.com and have it within 2 to 3 days. You can also get it online. You can order it from our website, which is delmarvareview.com. talbotcounty.com, and you can get it at local bookstores in the Talbot County area and libraries. But because of Amazon.com, you can get it if you're in London, if you're in Los Angeles, anywhere, you can order it and have it within days.
Wilson, as co-fiction editor, I've worked with you on a number of issues of the review. And I want you to know from my perspective what a spectacular job I think you've done. And I want you to know how much we appreciate your keen literary sense, your dedication, and the hard work that you've put into the Delmarva Review. And we're going to miss you as editor, but you're staying around for a while. We'd have to throw rocks at you, I think, to get rid of you. What's the new role that you're going to play?
I told Emily, who has replaced me as the editor, thankfully, that I'll be happy to read and to advise. There are some 5,000 literary journals published in the world, and we're among the better ones that has been published. And so there is competition even for us. So we have to be sharp in our competitive spirit.
Well, I look forward to working with Emily as well, but also to your continued presence. All right, Emily, big shoes to fill here.
Absolutely,
I believe.
Yep.
Tell us a bit about yourself, your background, and what is it that wants you to take on this role of being the executive editor of the Delmarva Review?
Well, you know, I've always liked to write, but I've come pretty late in life to creative writing and so on. Got involved with the Little Patuxent Review after they published one of my essays a few years ago. Became a reader with them. Then became nonfiction editor with them, and found really a passion for reading other people's work, for publishing really great work, and I'm excited to continue to do this with a Delmarva Review. Very excited.
Emily, have you been a literary critic in the past? And by that I mean, have you found yourself writing reviews of other people's work?
Really, no. I mean, sort of the only criticism that I have done is in reading submissions and critiquing them amongst the other editors.
Well, for this issue of the Delmarva Review, you work particularly on the essay. I know working with you, you read fiction submissions as well, but you focused primarily on the essays in this issue. Tell us a little bit about the essays as the submissions came in and as you read them.
So I have to say one thing about essays in general, essays and memoir, is they are such a pleasure to read, in my opinion, because no matter what, even if the writing is not quite there yet, it's somebody's story, and you learn so much about human nature and the human experience. And I do really enjoy reading nonfiction. I think we have very strong essays in this issue, and really excited to share them with people. I think there's in general, there is a strong theme of coping with these essays, coping with the deaths of loved ones, coping with disease, epilepsy, depression. But there's always some uplift there too. You know, all depression. There's meditations on creativity. There's one essay that I thought was really unique. It's called, and I love it for the title almost as much as the content. To the three suburban moms too frightened to drive their girls to my Detroit neighborhood. Really love it. Love it.
Is there a short paragraph to read to us, Emily?
Sure. I'm going to start with the second paragraph. Come this way. We won't sting or pinch, won't give you a second glance. These days, most of us are wary as turtles, heads crammed into shells. Wary as sloths beneath the weight of everyone's attention. The any moment now, when it swings like a trapeze to the next calamity. So by the time you read this, we'll already be forgotten.
That's wonderful. James Keegan, professional actor, professor at the University of Delaware in Georgetown, I believe. Writer and poet. As Wilson Wyatt said earlier, you're the featured writer in this issue. You have an essay and a number of poems. Tell us a little bit about yourself, and then I'm going to ask you to read one of your poems.
Sure. I'm really pleased to be here, and I'm really pleased to be the featured writer. It's very flattering, especially amid all this good writing. I've long written poetry, and you know, it's some of it has arisen out of the work that I've done as an actor. Primarily, I've been a classical actor, so performing Shakespeare roles. And for the last decade, I've worked at the American Shakespeare Center in Virginia, and it's a repertory theater, so with True Rep, a company doing 4 or 5 plays at once in rotation. So it's afforded me a lot of opportunity to be involved in plays and to play many characters. And so one of the things that happens, I think, is that one creative pursuit feeds another, and you have characters who are in the boundaries of their play, of the creation of a playwright. And then they take on such power and life and such fullness that I think inevitably, especially with actors who very often think about things like backstory, what has happened to this character before the play, what might happen to them after the play. And so you get caught up in that, and or I do at least, and that has led me to sort of explore those ideas. And the poems that I submitted for this issue included a number of poems that were sort of that stripe. So there's one that has to do with a character from Othello. There's one that has to do with Macbeth. In the year that I was playing Macbeth, I was thinking a lot about his experience. And then there's one that comes out of classical literature, and that's the one that I'll be reading that is about a character named Actaeon, who comes from Ovid's Metamorphosis. But my first encounter with that character was also in Shakespeare, because he's...
Where does he appear in Shakespeare?
Well, there's a reference to him in my favorite play, which is the comedy Twelfth Night. And when I was an undergraduate at Holy Cross many moons ago in Massachusetts, it was my first Shakespeare play that I was in. And I played the drunken uncle, Sir Toby Belch, which I've played a couple of times since. And there's a character, Orsino, who opens the play with this scene where he's talking about being in love with the lady Olivia. And when someone somebody's trying to distract him from his love, one of the people that works for him, and says, will you go hunt, my lord? And he says, what, Curio? What should I hunt, basically? And Curio very mistakenly says, the heart, H-A-R-T, for a deer.
Right.
And I think deer probably would have gotten him in trouble, too, because there's D-E-A-R. So when he's thinking of love, he's going to hear the puns on the words. And so he suggests hunting the heart. And, of course, Orsino, being all wrapped up in love, hears H-E-A-R-T. And so he says, why, so I do the noblest that I have. And then he compares himself to Actaeon. He says, when mine eyes did see Olivia first, methought she purged the air of pestilence. Then was I turned into a hart, and my desires like fell and cruel hounds ere since pursue me. So this idea that our desires pursue us and that they can run us to ground, I thought was a marvelous thing. And then I, as an undergraduate, I took some classics courses and got to read Ovid. And and fall in love with the original that Shakespeare himself had fallen so much in love with.
Well, I'm particularly partial to Ovid, as well, and I would appreciate it if you would read this poem. Troubling again over Ovid's story of Actaeon, and I think it might be helpful if you would take just a moment to say what happens in this in both Ovid's story and in your poem.
Certainly. Just for whenever I've read this poem, I always do a little bit of background on it because I don't assume that everyone has read Ovid's Metamorphoses. If you haven't, I highly recommend it. It's a great collection, an epic collection of stories from the ancient world. And the main theme of Ovid's Metamorphoses is transformation, change. And that's the main vehicle, I guess I should say. The main theme is probably human passion. But in this particular story of Actaeon, and it's a story that once I read it, I've always come back to, and the title of my own poem sort of gets at this, it's always bothered me. It troubles me when I read this story, because in Ovid's rendition of the story, and there are other accounts, Actaeon is a hunter, and he's really good at it. He's a famous hunter, and he has all these dogs that help him in his hunt. And in Ovid's story, Ovid actually names the dogs by name and breed, and he goes through a long list of them. So he pays a lot of attention to it, I think, to sort of capture the idea of how a hunter pays attention to his animals, you know. So he is out for a walk and happens upon a grotto where he sees the goddess of chastity, Diana, bathing. And that's a no-no because she is the goddess of chastity. So she throws water in his face to close his eyes. But she's a powerful being as well. So when the water hits his forehead, it begins to transform him. He starts to turn into that which he hunts. He turns into a deer. He is transformed. And then his own dogs get his scent and run him to ground and kill him. So it's a rather strict penalty for having seen the goddess Diana naked. Interestingly, Ovid himself, writing in the time of Augustus Caesar, before the Metamorphoses, wrote a couple of works about love and the art of love. And Augustus is famous for reinforcing traditional family values under his reign and had a tough time controlling the lusts of his own family, including his daughter and granddaughter, both named Julia. And so it appears that Ovid got blamed when Augustus was disciplining his own family. Ovid's work was seen as a bad influence, and he was relegated. It's a kind of banishment. When you were banished in the Roman world, you could lose all your property. If you were relegated, it meant that you retained your property, but you had to leave Rome. Ovid was a particularly cosmopolitan fellow, so to leave Rome and be relegated to a small seaport town on the Black Sea was a nightmare of exile for him. And so I think of, in the poem, I think of his poems being like Actaeon's hounds, that they express his desires and his focus, and they hunt him to ground.
Wonderful. But Ovid, and the Black Sea is probably thousands of miles from Rome. So he is really in the boondocks.
He's really on the verge, of the known world at the time.
Right, and he begged and worked to try to get
Augustus
back to the city, and never happened.
Never happened.
For him. Yeah. Read your poem, James. Okay. This is wonderful.
This is troubling again over Ovid's story of Actaeon. So here's what happened. Then you tell me. There's this great white hunter named Actaeon. He loves his hound dogs, stops by the kennel with scraps from his own plate, and gets right in there, wraps his sinewy arms around their necks, and feeds them from his own hand, because he needs for them to know him, and he wants to get a feel, a look, a sense for which of them to set on the double-cross fox, the switchback hart, the bayed boar, dangerous as die-hard Spartans. Ovid even lists the mutts, breed and name, and tells us from the get-go nobody's to blame for what's about to happen, that there's no crime. just the old bad luck. Wrong place, wrong time. He's off by himself for a walk. In every sense, pedestrian. Musing to himself of no immense mysteries, no sudden revelations. Some sweet thing back in town, maybe. How his spear needs sharpening. The latest model chariot he's been saving for, 2 horsepower with an option for 4, minding his goddamned business. Just out for a stroll. But before he can blink, he's got an eye full of the wet, glistening goddess au naturel. So averting his gaze ain't an option, pal. Besides, even if he could choose not to stare, his first accidental glimpse of the stripped bare, sequestered Olympian flesh, flushed and unpossessed in the hushed and miraculous clear pool grotto, her huntress hams taut as a bow, is enough. He's already good as dead. Her hot eye leveled on him like an arrowhead. But in that instant, before the scooped, flung water hits his face, shuts his eyes, he's caught her, Jove's daughter, and she is utterly taken in. Now, while it ain't no hymen-shattering sin, it isn't as if she'll ever be the same. They're both victims. Neither's to blame. So says Publius Ovidius Naso. Victimized himself by Caesar's say-so, relegated to the black sea stinkhole of Tomis, penning pleas for return to the Rome he's loved, his face wet as Actaeon's with tears, his poems like his own quick hounds in his ears. Even stumbled on, insight exacts its toll. Horns branch from the man's cuckolded skull, another fool to fortune, that fickle whore, who maneuvered him through an open door we can all see he never bargained for. And as if to go this injury one hurt more, the chaste, violated goddess of the hunt, one white hand clapped over her apprehended sex, as if in advance objection to 1950s stag film projections of the suburban bombshell, surprised in the shower by some unsuspecting stud come to check the power or the telephone, turns her voyeur into a stag with a rack he himself would have loved to bag. Did she impulsively select this skittish shape to reciprocate his bold-faced visual rape, or was the image a manifestation of his own fear-ridden imagination? Ovid refuses to provide explanation, trusting us to impress interpretations out of our own inner symbologies and needs. The heart runs, the dogs come, and Actaeon bleeds beneath their teeth and cannot give command, cannot hold out his so familiar hand for them to scent this poetic injustice, to fall all unknown under what is most precious to you, what is your own. Ovid looks out from his bleak seaport town, thinking of Caesar's irrevocable decree, of the suddennesses that alter us, you and me, of what truth denuded waits beyond some greeny bend to change us for our own whelped hunters to rend.
Troubling again.
Yeah.
James, what is troubling to you about the story?
Well, I think in Ovid's version of the story, Euripides mentions the story in the Bacchae, and he says that what Actaeon has done is boasted that he's a better hunter than Diana. And I get it. You don't boast to the goddess of the hunt that you are a better hunter than she is. She's going to give you payback for that. But in this version of the story, there's no connection like that. I mean, she is the goddess of the hunt, and she is the goddess of chastity and the moon and of childbirth, many womanly pursuits. So there's a kind of virginal femininity there. But all he does is sort of stumble on her, you know, and stumble into this moment of revelation. And it costs him everything, and not just costs him everything, but he gets taken down by the thing that he's most proud of and best known for. And I think that connection with Ovid just really struck me. But also it strikes me that
That's a shivery message for me to get as a person, you know, that I can be walking along in my life and I can encounter something that has the potential to destroy me and to even turn the things that I love best against me. And Ovid doesn't give any explanation for it, and I sort of love him for that, because he says, you know, this is the way the world works sometimes. Sometimes we walk into something, and it alters us completely and not in a way that we would have chosen.
It's this kind of an abstract semblance of fate.
Yeah.
And the whole Greek concept, to some degree, of fate. And the fact that the gods, for instance, they play with you at their will.
Mm-hmm.
And fate is something you can't avoid, something you that is just, as you just expressed, is just a part of life.
Yeah.
And you don't know.
It's like a current that you move in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
You can swim and stroke all you want, but the current's moving where it's moving.
No,
kind of
that's
thing.
Right. Yeah, yeah. That's right. And well, it's a wonderful poem and a wonderful.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. It's just beautiful. And if you tell us something about Actaeon. And his background, and what do you think happened? Where did Diana go after she after she curses, to use at least that more contemporary term? She curses Actaeon and actually sends him to his death at the jaws of his dog.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think in classical literature, you know, the immortals are represented sort of like regular human beings with passions and caprices and the like. But, of course, they're immortals, you know. So I don't know that she worries a lot about it, you know. I mean, I think she goes back into her enclosed grotto. I mean, I think for me in the story, she sort of represents the deeper mysteries, you know, and that we're not allowed into the deeper mysteries in most of our routine life. But every now and then we step right into the heart of one, and it can have, it can have marvelous effects, or it can have troubling, you know, effects. And I guess I get caught up on the troubling part.
Well, I think you're right. I think she is, the manifestation of fate. She doesn't care. She does what fate does, and to that extent, doesn't really care what happens to Actaeon. I think you've read that correctly, and the writing is just. Really, your writing is just really wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much.
And thank you for reading.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thanks.
One more time, please. Tell us where our listeners can get this issue of the Delmarva Review.
Well, in addition to Amazon.com, you can get it from the website, which is DelmarvaReview.com. And you can also get a 2-year subscription, which is a nice savings, by the way, from the website, DelmarvaReview.com.
Wilson, Emily, and James, congratulations on a great issue of the Delmarva Review. And thank you for joining me today on Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. We're going to take a short break now, and when we return, we'll have a short interview with Cécile Barlier, author of the short story in the review, Immersion, and a reading of that story by Ann Colwell. Please stay with us.
In our world, ideas can be liturgy. I'm Krista Tippett. Join me on Being, generous conversation about the questions that matter most. What does it mean to be human? And how do we want to live? We explore with theologians, scientists, philosophers, thinkers, and activists every week from American Public Media.
Sunday mornings at 7 on NPR News Talk 90.7.
Welcome back to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. We're going to present the short story Immersion now, published in this issue of the Delmarva Review. We're very fortunate to have Cécile Barlier, the author of Immersion, with us today. Cécile, congratulations on, frankly, what I find to be a wonderful story. Please tell us a bit about yourself and about the genesis of this excellent short story.
Well, thank you very much. First, for having my story published in your review, and also having me here with you today. So, a bit about myself. I am French. I've been in the U.S. now for about a little bit over 17 years. I've been around in the U.S., first on the East Coast in New York, and then down in South Carolina, and now I live in beautiful San Francisco, or very nearby in the East Bay. I started writing very late in my life, so I've been writing for about 8 years now. This is something I always wanted to explore, but this is something I've been doing more seriously now for only about 8 years. I've been attending here in the East Bay a wonderful writing workshop that allowed me to learn my skills over the last few years, and I was fortunate enough to get a few publications out. That's me in a nutshell. I also have another life, beyond writing. I'm an entrepreneur, and I work alongside with my husband here. We do reusable shopping bags. I have also two wonderful children, two daughters that are 12 and 14. And about the story Immersion, this story, the genesis of that story started, I believe it was in the summer of last year, I want to say. My husband came back from traveling to France, and he brought a magazine with him, French magazine, that featured an athlete that was doing free diving. And he was fascinated by this man and by this article. And he went up to me and said, "You should write a story about free diving." And I thought this was a wonderful idea. Captivated me on several fronts. And I read the article, and then I was fairly stuck because I didn't want to write a story about an athlete. I did not have it in me or didn't feel the connection right away. And then I thought, well, this is coming from my husband, isn't it? So shouldn't I write a couple story? And that's how it started. So I started writing about this couple who's exploring the free diving world.
Well, we're gonna listen to the story in just a moment. But Cécile, you haven't been doing any free diving yourself, have you?
No, I haven't. I've been scuba diving and being in the sea, but never free diving myself. No.
Well, I don't know if you had it in mind, Cécile, but Of course, in the story, I was fascinated with the diving and the breathing exercises in the story. But at the same time, I'll be very frank with you, and I'll tell our listeners this as well. For me, the entire story was also a beautiful metaphor. And you work a bit on that metaphor, but this is more than a story about breathing and diving down to depths. Well, Cecile, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. And now, Immersion, read by Anne Colwell.
My husband and I first started dynamic apnea as a way to combat our Sunday lulls. It's true we needed a behavioral change, something that would take the edge off those suicidal dominical afternoons. I remember laying it out there on the dining room table between the breadcrumbs and the coffee mugs. It's not like we didn't know it was coming. It was coming. On the tail of Sunday morning tennis and Sunday morning run, came in that order, boredom, self-observation, emptiness, hopelessness, and an exhausting sense of isolation. I remember my husband commenting that perhaps it was okay, his blue eyes fixed on mine, his right leg in a perpetual shake. He was waiting for me to add or do something. I remember well not knowing what it was he was waiting for or wondering if he was waiting at all. And so I blacked out, my face like a close-up on a TV quiz show, all my blemishes blown up and a large-scale dumbness. And then one thing led to the next. I looked up at our TV screen in the corner of the room and saw Dwayne Johnson roaring underwater in the blockbuster about a gigantic earthquake. The TV paused there as if it was too much for the screen to move on. Dwayne Johnson's open jaw struck me as marvelous. Something relaxed in me at the sight of this colossal, diagonally tilted face. Having a mimetic imagination, I, too, tilted my head sideways. It was a gesture that was perhaps meant as a sign of submissiveness, but I never thought of it that way. In any case, that's when I said it. With my head still tilted, I said to my husband, "I'll tell you what. We'll do this. From now on, we'll go free diving on Sunday afternoons." He agreed, on the spot. There was no objection, no standoff, no request for time to reflect. I remember him smiling in the void across the dining room table, carefully assembling the breadcrumbs in one spot and slowly wiping them off the table into his left palm. My husband always cleaned the crumbs this way, using both his hands without a sponge. Maybe I can say it like this. My husband and I needed to stop breathing each other's breath. Or maybe I can say it like that. My husband and I always shared one single oxygen tank. A bit of research led us to a small local freedivers community and a neighborhood pool with dedicated hours. Dynamic training started pool-based for obvious reasons. It was safe, controlled, warm, and familiar. There was an instructor with an exceedingly common name which my husband and I kept forgetting. I alternately called him Mike or Bob or John. He was pretty sweet and never took offense or tried to correct me. Perhaps he was relieved by the anonymity. Between us, my husband referred to him as G.I. Joe because he was so cut and dried and decent and thin. He projected an unguarded curiosity, a sort of gentle expectation. He'd stop most of his sentences midway, letting the missing half float through the mind of the listener. He didn't have the conventional authority you'd expect of an instructor. His clout derived from the calm openness of people who speak with moderation. The first phase of the training happened outside of the water, and G.I. Joe started by teaching us warm-up routines. It was implicit from his half-speak that those were mostly meant for thoracic stretching. The more flexible our torso, the more air we'd be able to take in with a maximum breath. Other drills focused on empty lung stretches, which would allow us to compress at depth and hopefully reduce our residual volume. Each routine didn't have to be long, 15 to 20 minutes at most. The main thing was to settle our minds before a dive. My husband and I didn't know much about breathing. This was not something that had required much thought. Breathing had been one more thing that he and I did 24/7. G.I. Joe's routine turned it into something to think about, something that could be improved constantly. You could breathe deep or shallow, hyperventilate or stop. You could fill up your lungs till they burst or empty them until your thorax would flatten like a crepe. Breathing became this thing my husband and I cared about, this thing that had to be done better, alone and as a couple. After weeks of practicing the routines, breathing became second nature as well as a major distraction. You could say that conscious breathing saturated this phase of our lives. My husband started commenting on other people's breathing and how it shaped them into who they were, how it really determined their fate. He kept looking for cues in people around him, reporting the number of breaths his boss would take during their weekly meetings, timing the average length of a sigh from one of his colleagues who was prolific with them. For me, it seemed obvious to use apnea as a weapon. I practiced preemptive apnea with obnoxious salespeople in shoe stores or when riding the elevator with neighbors whose faces I didn't like. One day, I stopped breathing as one of my cousins commented on the poor shape of our teacups. My husband came into the room at that moment and noticed what I was doing. He joined me in the process. That got us into further and longer experiments. No one around us seemed to notice, and I liked that. When someone breathed oddly in our presence, my husband would exhale quietly as though he were telling me a secret, but loud enough so everyone could hear. In a matter of weeks, breathing and the absence thereof had become code. I suspected my husband trained more than I did. Both of us were competitive, but he was more. There was an escalation in how he approached what had first started as a hopeless joke. My husband always had a limitless admiration for top-level sportsmen and women. Now he had a chance to physically embrace their culture, training, rigor, work, persistence, and repetition. He spent more time in the bathroom than I ever knew him to. He was clearly training there, taking long baths with the door closed. I tried eavesdropping, but all I got was a breathless quiet. His training started taking more and more space in the apartment. Silence and shadows swirled around the plants on our windowsills. In the beginning, I remember feeling lonely and let down. I regretted having suggested freediving in the first place, but I never wanted to be a wimp, so all I could do was to start training seriously anywhere, at any time, until I got better myself. I pushed my limits. One evening, I was practicing empty lung spells as I was walking down the stairs with groceries, and I fell flat on my forehead. I passed out cold and woke up on my husband's chest, then fell asleep or half asleep, my aching head floating up and down his ribcage. I remember listening to his low heartbeat as he started to grab me. I tried to stay stuck to him, to his torso, which wasn't easy. We fought in the dark, and of course, we stopped breathing. It was lovely, the kind of bittersweet thing that happens between two boxers as they fall into each other's arms after 10 rounds. After that night, trying to find sleep on my husband's chest became this habit, my head sandwiched between his skin and the bedsheets, holding on to his rhythm. I remember thinking that his heartbeat was the metronome of my downtime. But that would be only partially true. Many kinds of beats were part of my night world at that time. Our building sat on a hill overlooking a highway. I don't know how many times I woke up in the middle of the night and stood on the balcony, cutting darkness with my hands. I had quit smoking. Listening to the incessant buzz of cars, people coming and going all the time. The night would rise and fall as this giant lung, and I could insert myself in its cavities, hyper-small, unbreathing, and unyielding. Once before dawn, my unusually perky husband in his boxer shorts joined me on the balcony. He carried a book, a flashlight, and a pencil for a new exercise he had devised. He asked me to sit on the floor and make myself comfortable. He instructed me to open the book to a random page, take in a deep breath and hold it, and continue holding it as I started reading under the halo of his flashlight. I should keep reading, he said, until I couldn't hold my breath any longer. I had to mark how far down I had read with the pencil. He would keep track of my progress, and he'd mark his own with a different shaped mark, a small triangle. I remember he asked for orange juice that same morning, and there was none. I remember forgetting to buy orange juice several weeks in a row. I think it was the same week, or maybe that same day, that I read about another possible practice on the internet. All that was needed was a sidewalk and a stopwatch. During our morning walk to the train station for work, I instructed my husband to start holding his breath for 1 minute while standing still. After the minute had passed, I made him start walking down our street at a calm but steady pace, maintaining his breath hold. He should go as far as he could without breathing. One day, he almost made it all the way to the station. I remember the day I made it. I had cheated. I was going to say I had cheated, but I hesitated for a second. Then I realized quite clearly that no, I didn't want to say it. I started buying orange juice again. G.I. Joe was surprised by how good both of us were after only 3 months of practicing the routines. According to him, my husband and I were ready for the pool series. Pool sessions lasted about an hour, half of it outside and half in the water. G.I. Joe was so thin you could count his ribs. He was constantly cold, and his lips would turn purplish 5 minutes into the lesson. Despite that, he never wore a wetsuit. It was against his religion, or so he semi-said. The pool was relatively small, not Olympic. The locals talked about a mega pool that was in the works. It was like they were talking about a dream. I could never find out whether they were making this up. To be honest, I never tried. Size didn't matter. At least, not in the beginning. Initially, we went every Sunday for group sessions, but then we started going weekdays in the evening as we found out that G.I. Joe was trying to round up figures by offering privates. I knew my body wasn't ready for the blind swim. I knew it as soon as I saw the roll of duct tape on the diving block. Something in me didn't agree with duct tape. I was ready to give up breathing, but not seeing. I said nothing. I decided that keeping quiet and letting my husband go first was a very effective way to buy time. I had begun to figure out that my husband could do things I wasn't ready to do myself, and the annoyance of that thought fueled whatever part in me wasn't a chicken. Even though I did everything I could to repress my irritation, the idea of not keeping up with him had become, for me, the most devastating thing imaginable. "Please go," I said when he asked. I watched G.I. Joe cover my husband's mask with strips of duct tape so he couldn't see it through it at all. G.I. Joe was very methodical, and the duct tape was silver and textured like a sheet of coarse fabric. "Fancy duct tape," I said stupidly, and I remember that, in that moment, something dark and sexual soared in the back of my mind. Under G.I. Joe's instructions, I guided and accompanied my blind, masked husband into the pool. I took him to the side and placed his hands on the wall right under the surface of the water. After taking a deep breath, he dove under the surface and started swimming slowly down the side of the pool, guiding himself only by touch. I was instructed to dive with him, to be his apnea mate, watching underwater and swimming along. I remember the feeling of being swallowed by the water, trying to be absent from myself, to almost fall asleep, to imagine my blind husband as a dream. During the first pool length without breathing, I made myself as empty as possible. I tried not to think at all, Thoughts appeared, of course, but I didn't hold on to them. I let them slide through me and dissolve in the water like sugar cubes. I don't remember what the thoughts were, just that they were very soluble. Totally empty, I'd consume a minimum of energy and oxygen. I remember feeling like a standby screen with the eye of a micro camera pointed at my husband. Someone was shouting up above. G.I. Joe's encouragements got through to us like wet whale songs. My diaphragm began contracting toward the end of the third pool length. The spasm started as my husband initiated his third turn. From then on, I knew they'd become more intense and closer together. I was entering the fighting phase. There was no cheating in the pool. There was no out. There was only my husband swimming slowly along the wall. I remember thinking that if he did, then perhaps I could hold a little longer. Perhaps I close my eyes. Next, I remember my husband lifting me out of the water, holding me in his arms like an oversized baby. I remember the warm, rubbery texture of his short fingers on my ribcage. I remember thinking of something terrible and forgetting immediately. 1 year after my husband and I started freediving, the group organized a trip to a miniature and southerly island off the coast. It was a small and intimate outing headed by G.I. Joe. The water was warm and the skies were clear. There was a 20-meter line to follow for the divers, a standard beginner's length. G.I. Joe wanted us to take a few of them for fun. My husband and I hadn't exactly become pro divers by then, but each of us had sufficient diving experience to be invited on that excursion. That afternoon, G.I. Joe accompanied us on each dive and took some on his own to unknown depths. He failed to resurface on his third dive. The group didn't panic right away. There was a rather slow-building anxiety that developed to a climax as the timer kept ticking. My husband dove to look for him, and I followed. There was this moment when the two of us were at the bottom of the rope looking. The water was very clear, and there was no sign of life anywhere. No fish. No G.I. Joe. There was nothing but the textured ceiling of the water surface and the fragmented light that came through it. My husband and I waited immobile, with our arms down by our sides and our hands half opened. My husband's wetsuit looked ash blue underwater, like the skin of a marine mammal reupholstered on a human shape. The fear that I had felt on the surface was different down there, thicker and sharper, compressed by the water density as the absence of oxygen. I remember when the quietude hit us, when my husband and I knew for sure that G.I. Joe was lost. And that's when I stopped looking and thinking that he would inevitably show up somewhere underneath us, swimming upward like a ghost jellyfish. I decided to quit. At that very moment, I stopped wanting to dive. I suppose that's also when my husband's aspirations began to be quashed. He and I never had, in any case, long nightly discussions about what had happened. Maybe because that was when the desire for babies arrived. 10 months later, I was pregnant. Our apartment was bigger and had a freestanding tub with lion's feet. Every once in a while, I soaked in it, or I just sat in it empty and got lost in watching my naked belly grow. I worshipped that bathtub. I scrubbed it clean after each use. I remember wanting it spotless. I had a premonitory religious fervor for that tub. The day it happened, I watched a wet spot spreading underneath me on the couch like an island in formation. Perhaps I had a moment between contractions where I could actually think like that about islands being formed. My husband was out shopping. I moaned on the telephone. He said to wait for him. I moaned again. Some instinct pushed me in the bathtub and made me turn the water on full throttle. I waited for my husband. At some point, I put my head underwater. I decided to wait until I could not wait any longer. I remember thinking that this was going to be the most romantic moment in my life.
Thank you, Anne, for a beautiful presentation. Immersion, Cécile Barlier. The Delmarva Review is available at Amazon.com and at local bookstores in the Delmarva area. Thank you all for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.